This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk, and today I'm talking to Claire Missoud about her novel, The Burning Girl, which is a book I really, really enjoyed reading, and I hope listeners will find this conversation intriguing enough to go out and buy the book for themselves. How are you, Claire?
I'm well. Thanks, David. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, this was a really interesting book to me. It's a book about two girls, but the narrator is telling the story about her friend. Her name is Julia. Her friend is Cassie, and they grew up together, as so often happens. You know, people have best friends from kindergarten or nursery school, and then things change. While we don't want to tell the whole story of the book, I think it centers around this friendship, but also about the way that friendships change and what they mean to us through that period of adolescence and into kind of young adulthood. I was curious about whether this was sparked by something important in your own life.
Well, whenever I sit down to write something, it always is about, I think of it as sort of magpie thing. You know, I take a piece from over here and a piece from there and a piece from under the table. And in this instance, it was a combination of things, one of which is that we have two kids who are teenagers now and nieces and nephews who are teenagers also. And it means that in the past 5 or 7 years, I've spent a lot of time around teenagers, young teenagers, now older, who are going through those sorts of experiences that are fairly universal, and that of course reawakened in me the memory of my own adolescent experiences. And so it's just been something that's been very central to my life, that I've experienced as almost in palimpsest. So that I, you know, there's the younger generation's experience before my eyes, and then this reliving of my own from years ago. And it's amazing how the emotions are still so, you know, my own emotions in memory are still so strong.
That, I think, is one of the things that, you know, I was thinking about how it is so universal an experience for modern, let's say, Americans. I don't know the lives of kids in other countries, but it seems fairly, this is something that many of us can relate to, male or female, that at a certain point, it's typically junior high school, you know, where people change and the relationships change. The person who was your best friend when you were young is no longer the same kind of person that you would normally hang out with. So this rift occurs, which is what happened with Julia and Cassie. That seemed very familiar.
Yes. I think sooner or later, middle school is a junior high is a sort of, I think, there's probably a bell curve, you know, and for some people it happens in fifth grade, and for other people it happens in 11th grade, or maybe it happens in college. I mean, you know, people have this experience maybe at different times, but it is, I think, central, that sort of, maybe breakup is too strong a word, but unraveling certainly is really part of growing up. And I think it has to do in part with the fact that those are the years in which, you know, we all say, oh, teenagers all want to conform and so on. And that comes out of the fact that when you're a kid, you're less aware of context. You just take what's given to you and you sort of accept it, and you figure if it's in front of you, it must be normal. And then all of a sudden, as you move into these years, you become aware of, you start juxtaposing or comparing, and you think, well, if what's normal, is my family normal? Because if my family's normal, then her family's not normal, or vice versa. Maybe my family's not normal, it becomes, when you're a kid, there aren't boundaries. You don't ask questions. It's more like being, you know, puppies in a field playing, and then all of a sudden, growing into self-consciousness, it's this awareness of all the strangenesses of being you, but also all the strangenesses of everybody else being them.
Right. And I think also you become aware of judgmentalness in a way that wasn't, you know, it's kind of the, well, we call it innocence of youth, but there, I think that boundary is very important, that there's a period in your life where you are absorbing information and you're not judging you don't judge whether the person or the experience is a good one. It is, as you were saying, it is the experience that you have, and you don't question it. But then there's that somehow that mysterious point at which you become self-aware, or even more so, you begin to take on the awareness of others.
Right. Well, and that latter piece, I think, is such a big part of it. You know, thank heavens, you know, our daughter's now, she's 16, she's going to 11th grade. I feel like this moment has passed, but there was a moment in about 7th grade when she could have given you a sort of the popularity ranking of her entire class from 1 to 60. Yeah. Like, you know, she could have just put them all in order and she had this sort of tacit but totally firm set of rules. Like, I can speak to somebody, you know, up to 10 points cooler than I am, but only if they're not with somebody, not in the presence of somebody who's 10 points cooler than them, because otherwise they won't then speak. I mean, just insane. I mean, I think she was particularly sort of OCD about it, but I think some version of that is going on for every kid when it, you know, for years and years beforehand, it never did.
Right, that's true. Well, you know, one of the lines in your book that I thought was very important, and I'm going to read it to you because I think, obviously, you wrote it, you know this line, but each of us shapes our stories so they make sense of who we think we are. That's your main character speaking. And I thought that was not only about her, but it's really about you. And because you're the writer, you're telling these stories. And each of us shapes our stories, so they make sense. That's what you're doing here, in a way. I mean, that's what the book is about.
Yes, and for me, at least, the book is about, you know, the book is about this, that particular instance with these two girls, but it's also about, that's just what we all do. It's what each and every one of us does in our lives. It's what we do as in a community or in a culture. You know, I mean, I think in our broader society right now, one of the really complicated things is that different people have very different stories of what America is and who Americans are.
Right. And, we don't have a shared mythology anymore. So.
Right, and we're all telling these different stories, and they don't necessarily agree. And how are we going to make sense of that, you know? So I think it's something that happens at every level, and that happens all through our lives, and happens, you know, it happens when you fall in love. You tell a story about, you know, how we met and what it meant and how we fell in love, or you know, anything, how your career progresses, you have a story about it that involves leaving some things out and emphasizing some other things, and you're not even necessarily aware of what you've left out.
Right. Well, that's true. We create, and that's a whole other thing, we create our own self-imagined story, about our lives. And I think part of what you have Julia doing here is she's telling herself this story, and trying to, you know, kind of create the mythology of what happened.
Yes, absolutely. And she's also, you know, one of the things that I hope this isn't sort of giving too much away to your readers, but she's the narrator of the story the whole way through, and she's the narrator of things, of events at which she's not present.
Right. No, she has to, exactly right. She has to, that's the act of imagination that, and what you have her doing is actually what every novelist ultimately does.
Yes. Making stuff up.
Right.
Right. She has a certain amount to go on, and then she's not really owning up to how, I mean, there are places where she reminds the reader, you know, this is how I imagined it, or this is what I think, but a lot of the time she's just telling it as if it was, you know, as if she'd been there when she wasn't.
Well, but that's also partly another kind of circle within the story, and that is when they're young, They both, Cassie and Julia, do what every kid does, and that is take, as we were talking about, they take in experiences and then they make up stories about what is happening or what might have happened to explain what they're seeing. And
right.
And they don't always know that that's true or not, but they, it gives them an understanding. It gives them a framework for interpreting experience.
Right. And again, it's what, you know, if it, that's what, that's, I, another sort of, inspiration or catalyst behind this book for me is in some sort of more remote or subterranean way, is having spent, because when my kids, before they were teenagers, they were younger, is having spent a lot of time immersed in children's literature and Greek myths and fables and so on, you know, after a long time of not being. And, right. And of course, what Greek myths are or, you know, or us, you know, this, the Australian Aboriginal Dreamtime stories, or you know, Native American stories. These are the fables and myths that make sense of natural phenomena, so the way that people always have explained life through stories, and sometimes rather magical stories, or sometimes, you know, but that we that's our impulse. That's how we make order. It's how we make sense of the world, is to make up these stories that that explain it, and that we don't really, on some level, need to know. We don't need to know, or don't want to know, how true or untrue they might be.
Well, and of course, there is always that ultimate question, because as quantum physics now indicates to us, our reality may entirely be made up by our consciousnesses.
Right. Well, I, you know, which is also, I think, not Kant didn't go that far, but I think Fichte, who I believe was a student of Kant, a sort of German romantic, I think he went that far. You cannot, there is nothing beyond our own subjectivity. I say table. Kant was like, I say table, I have one thing, you say table, but we can both reach out and touch the table. And Fichte, I think Fichte was at the point of, nope, you know, there's no table. But our will of the table,
right.
Our imagining of the table. Right.
Or actually, and what quantum physics, I think, would say is, yes, there is a table, but it only exists because we imagine it.
Yes.
Which I think actually relates to some of the memory and events in the story. I think I can't remember the name of the building that they discover.
The Bonnybrook.
Bonnybrook. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I was going to call it mm-hmm. Brookhaven for some reason.
No, pretty cool. Because there is, because you know, up my way, there is not a mental institution, but a retirement home called Brookhaven. I think it's a common
right. There are probably a lot of Brookhavens in the world, but Bonnybrook, which is a kind of, you know, terrifying name for a place that it was, right. Is this, you know, abandoned, asylum that the girls find early, you know, relative, well, let's call it partway through the story when they're still young. And it becomes, yeah. I think that becomes a kind of touchstone place. But it is also filled with a lot of mysterious meaning, I think, for you in this story.
Yes. Yes. And in all sorts of ways. I mean, it's almost, on some super abstract level, you could say it is their shared unconscious, right?
Yeah.
It is the shared history of that, both in the sense that they go there and play there, but and then have a memory of it that they don't so much talk about, but also in the sense that it's a place that started out as a sort of grand mansion, you know, an aristocratic New England mansion, and ended up being an asylum, you know, a mental institution specifically for women. And it raises all sorts of questions for me, you know, the idea of that there's this, first of all, I started by having come across, this is somewhere far away. We were spending a year in Germany, and you know, there was this abandoned asylum that was not far away, and we went to visit. And but Massachusetts is full of such buildings. I don't know if Connecticut is also.
Oh,
but,
yeah, it is.
Yeah, and just the very idea that our history, our cultural history, is sort of literally hidden in the woods, a mile away from where we live. crumbling, and we sort of disregard it. But everything that went with that, a whole back to the question of telling stories, there was a time when even when I was young, you know, when we thought you can say somebody's sane and somebody's not sane, there's a boundary. If they're not sane, we lock them up, right? That's our story, is that this is a clear line, and we, you know, there are people who define it. We have doctors who define it, and once it's defined, we know how to behave, and there's a sort of control and an order and a boundary, and anything that we need to sort of put away, we literally put it away in this house in the woods, and then we don't have to worry about it anymore. And that the cultural shift then, which took place in I think basically in the 80s and 90s, maybe in the 70s also, but from the 70s onwards, say, which means that almost very few people are as clear about what that line is anymore.
Right. Well, those institutions don't exist.
They don't
now.
Exist.
Right. They're voluntary usually, or they're for people who, you know, there are places where one goes. Like what would be familiar to, say, kids today would be, you know, a detox center, or, you know, a place where you go when you're trying to get off drugs or get off of alcohol.
Right.
But those are all kind of voluntary, and it has different meaning. I think the idea of a place where literally, and I put this in quotes, crazy people go.
Right, right.
That's very powerful. And I think, the building becomes this stand-in for the cultural attitudes that were in place in that period of time.
Right, right. Well, my hope is that it has a sort of actual sort of physical, you know, sounds, smells, textures, presence that has its own logic in the story, but that somewhere behind the story that echo of its significance is sort of lurking, because this is a story about kids growing up and about their friendship, but it's also a story about what shapes who we become, and the things that shape who we become, some of them we're very aware of and others we're less aware of. And for girls, in particular, there's a different set, you know, many of the things are just cultural and pertain to everyone regardless of race, class, gender, and so on. But some things are specifically, I think, experiences that girls have as we grow into women, and I felt that echo is in part there for me anyway in the Bonnie book.
Well, and it's also, I did notice, there are several scenes, and there are kind of moments where Julia talks about that, how what women, girls have to think about, which I think is definitely different from what boys, men think about as they're growing up. That's definitely true. And I thought some of the what we would call minor characters kind of were, you know, there were scenes where that was evident. There's one scene that I think it's okay to talk about where Cassie is in her neighborhood. You know, she has a difficult family experience, whereas Julia does not. And that's a, mm-hmm. you know, an important contrast. But there's that scene where we see Cassie on the street leaving her house at night. She's probably 14 or 15. And one of the neighbors sees her and kind of makes her get in the car. But so much of the power of that scene was Julia imagining what it was like for Cassie to have a man accosting her in the middle of the night. And that was really, I thought that was very powerful. I think that you captured that feeling in a way that I think a man would not naturally know how to understand. I thought that was really important.
Oh, well, thank you. And I mean, it's interesting. It was important to me too, to make clear that this was Julia's imagining of what Cassie experiences, because I think also that element of fear is is subjective. So there are many
right, it was
girls
Julia's
and women,
fear, right?
Right. Many girls and women have that fear. And then there are others who, whether they're just not fearful innately or whether they make a decision that they won't be afraid, they don't experience that fear, you know? And so, but I think it's interesting. I've had so many conversations over now so many years. I would say it's really a significant proportion of women who, starting from this time, and you know, you don't feel it as a 9-year-old. You don't. When you're a little kid, you don't. Those questions haven't really come up, and that's not to say you're entirely safe. I mean, I'm you know, tragically, sometimes terrible things. Rarely, but sometimes terrible things happen to kids. But it's part of growing up into being a woman, you know, that when you hit puberty, that there are all these things. And as a parent, you know, going through it as a parent, I've been aware of that it is different. You know, I want my daughter to be strong and free and independent and all of those things as much as my son. Our son is younger. But I'm aware that there are just, you know, that if he's, you know, at an age when he's younger, if he says, I'll just come home, you know, I'll just come home on my bike, or I'll just walk home and it's dark, you know, at 13, he's doing that. At 13, she was not doing that. We were not letting her walk home a mile in the dark, you know?
Yeah, no, that is.
It's just different.
It is different. And it is, I think that also relates to people's understanding of otherness, not just of male and female, but of race and class, mm-hmm. that it comes about at roughly that same age of puberty. And I think it probably is kind of it's so important because of sex. And it's,
yes.
You know, because of what sex means in our society, all of the relationships with others revolve around that.
Yes, yes. It's a strange, it's strange because I think we don't fully acknowledge it.
True. I agree.
I think we pretend, I mean, in the same way that we pretend that we don't have, that there isn't social class in the United States, when obviously, you know, your experience, your financial experience affects so much, right? But we always say, oh, there's no such thing as social class in America, but it isn't really true. And I think we also, we have found it easier to deny historically, you know, to deny issues also of race and gender, as determining, but as you say, sex behind it all, we don't have a way of addressing it, right?
No,
it doesn't fit the story. I feel like if it doesn't fit the story of equality and equal opportunity the way we want it to.
Right. No, I think that's exactly the point, that it's a kind of enforced mythology that, and of course it does go to what you were talking about earlier, that we do have stories about what the meaning of our culture is. And that's one of them. And it tends
right.
to, but it's kind of enforced politically and culturally in a way that, I mean, of course, it's inaccurate.
Yeah. Yes. It's such an interesting thing, because if we don't have, does a slightly inaccurate story then become aspirational, as it were, like we can only move towards the society that we want by having this, this sort of slightly inaccurate story, and that's what we aspire to and move towards, or you know, and there are many instances. For some reason, what comes to mind is I remember learning about France after the Second World War, that de Gaulle, the General de Gaulle, when he became the president, he changed he sort of changed the narrative of an embittered and compromised France, where, you know, they had been occupied and defeated. He sort of put to the fore the narrative of the French as resistors. And, you know, his narrative was that far more people had been in the resistance than were actually in the resistance.
Right.
He felt it was culturally important in order for France to be the nation, you know, to move forward as a nation and rebuild and have hope, that actually, you know, that to tell a slight untruth about how it had been seemed to him necessary for moving forward.
Right. But then the counter argument to that, of course, is that by masking the truth, we don't grapple with the inconsistencies
Exactly. And
the problems that are underlying all of that false narrative, which, you know, you have to call it a false narrative.
Yes.
And so it allows us to never reconcile what are really, you know, the issues that are really going on.
Yes. Yes. And so I feel that, you know, in the end, each of us individually has to come down somewhere on that. And I feel like, you know, I come down on the truth side. Maybe you come down on the truth side. Like, even if it's unpalatable, we got to go with the truth. But again, back to this question of the stories of our culture, it isn't the only choice. It isn't the only place to come down.
Right. Well, and then maybe it is, I mean, of course, we're sort of imagining too what, you know, whether that is, you know, how, what is the role of these stories that we tell ourselves? But then there's the kind of macro level that we're talking about now. And then there's the more micro level, which is really what your book is about. And that is the day-to-day storytelling in some ways is more what people cleave to. You know,
yes.
We kind of emotionally, yes, we all think of those bigger stories and of the kind of large scale countrywide myths. But what really drives most people's everyday lives are these real stories of the things that take place in their lives.
Yes, of course. Yes, so true. And I think even there, it's almost, you know, for me at least, when I was writing this book, one of the things I was aware of is that in so many cases, we hear part of us in the small, intimate sort of daily life, we hear part of a story and we think, oh, I know how that story goes. I know how it ends up, without necessarily actually paying close attention to the individual and the circumstances. You know, I think, and that happens to girls in puberty a lot, like the girls who develop physically earlier, so they have breasts earlier and they look older, younger, you know, they get historically, this was, you know, historically they did, but anecdotally I think it hasn't changed. They get literally reputations, right? Why? Because back to the sex thing, because we know how that story goes.
Right.
Right. I don't need to know the, you know, unless, and then many girls sort of actually act to counter that narrative by, you know, putting on big heavy sweatshirts and slumping their shoulders and having their hair in front of their eyes. Like, that's another alternative, you know. But you have to contend with the micro stories that our culture already has in place. You have
right.
to contend with them somehow.
Well, that's true. And I think actually when you think about feminism and what it's done, which is very powerful, I think it's changed the opportunities and changed the stories and changed the possibilities for women over the last 40 or 50 years. But at the same time, on the micro level, every girl in high school will go through some variation of an old story.
Yes. Yes. And well, as we said, you know, back at the beginning of the conversation, we were talking about, you know, almost everybody loses a friend sometime. You know, there are just certain, there are certain passages that are universal, virtually universal.
I think that's the power of storytelling, is to point those out and to make them personal for
yes.
others. So, you know, in that way, this is a very successful book. Look what it got us to talk about and think about.
Oh, well, thanks.
So just out of one little curious kind of mundane question, when you think about Julia, who is the narrator, and she's kind of your voice because you're telling the story, you're telling her story and Cassie's story, how do you imagine her life goes from the point on from the book without necessarily, you know, I know you might have another novel in mind for her, but maybe not. But where do you think she goes? Does she go to college and does she actually take up acting, or what happens to her?
You know, I'm not going to answer that, David. I feel as though I might have my ideas. I might think I know how the story goes. But one of the things that I want very much, I think when I'm writing, you know, just writing at all, but certainly that I felt with this book is that I want it to be open for the reader's imagination, and. I want that openness to reflect or make space for each of us for our individual experiences, so that any reader can imagine that what they think might happen to Cassie or Julia, you know, down the line, and that it's not for me to say that's imagining it wrong. Do you know what I mean?
Oh yeah. In
the same way, like life is full of mystery. I do. That's one of the things that I feel much more now than I felt 20 years ago. I'm 50 now, and it's not like I feel like I'm getting things sorted out and I have a ever clearer idea of how things work. I just feel as though things are more and more mysterious, and I have more and more wonder at the unexpected turns of life. And I'm not
going to
answer.
That's good. No, I think that's actually a good question to what is ultimately an unfair question. So, so thanks for that. Well, I loved this book. I really enjoyed talking to you as well. I hope that I'll get a chance to talk to you again and maybe read another one of your books.
Oh, thank you, David. I really enjoyed our conversation, too. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. I've been talking to Claire Missoud about The Burning Girl, a novel.